discussion could be on track for fair to hold up until our next Q3 AM on Thursday, March 3rd, 2022, ending March 26. And as president are Representative Marquez, Representative Fields, and myself, Representative Zelensky, Chair. But the record reflects that we will have to give minutes for council members. Please take this time to silence yourself for the duration of the meeting. And if president will not be, if you would remain muted unless you were speaking. Before we begin, as always, I'd like to thank my committee for the House Journal Affairs Secretary for your records and Alex Meany from the Tribunal Bureau for staff in the committee today. We are going to be continuing discussion about public safety issues today. We will hear about a testimony of a topic of missing and read Indigenous people from Commissioner Jim Cockrell of the Department of Labor. We're also going to be having a hearing on House Bill 313, a companion bill to Senate Bill 81 relating to the Village Public Safety Officer Program. First, we will turn to Commissioner Cockrell. Commissioner, thank you for coming back in front of the committee. We know that you're traveling this morning, so if you could begin by introducing yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, good morning. I'm James Cockrell, Commissioner of the Parks Department of Public Safety, coming from my office in Acres as well. And I'm not sure if Chair Martin is going to just want me to ask questions and want me to just go into some testimony.
Sure, if you would like to just begin by going into some testimony on the background of the work that's been done within the executive branches of the department on this topic, and if there are questions, we'll take the committee.
Okay, to the chair. First, I'd like to start off and recognize the credit the department has, the support that we have in Fairbanks with the conviction of the self-assertion murder that occurred in 1993. It took the department almost 30 years to bring a person to justice that committed a murder at the University of Fairbanks. Stephen Downs, Maine. For 7 years old, well, most likely spend the rest of his life in prison for that brutal murder. And to start off with, I'd like to touch on a little bit more difficult when I met a person. Sorry I couldn't make it down there today, but I will pull up the other testimony after this hearing because I just hear some pretty wide range of guests that's going to testify today. One of the things I wanted to do is first let's touch on what the department is doing currently and what we're looking towards the future in handling missing and murdered Indigenous people and specifically from Alaska. Currently, missing person clearinghouse says that we have approximately 1,300 people that are currently missing. That goes all the way back into the 1960s. That involves 1,097 males, 203 are females, and about 55 are identified as Alaska Native. And as we know, we've got plenty of documentation that in our state, Alaska Natives, specifically Alaska Native women, are victimized at a higher rate than any other race in our state. And as a department, that's one of the things that we focus on. We have to do a better job to protect our people and more or less as I've testified earlier. Currently, if you look at our FY23 budget request, we are focused on trying to increase our presence in rural Alaska, and with that hope, that will prevent and be able to further investigate incidents where we have missing Alaska Natives in our communities, and specifically females. And we've asked for program victim witness paralegal support to support our victims in rural Alaska, when we're going to bump them, when we're going to the Martin Sound area, in and around the past, the warning site, yet we're the best place to put that person. But when a person is victimized, that will keep, we'll have continuous contact with that victim to ensure that person, the perpetrator, is held investigative skills. A forensic tech in Bethel to permit to provide correctional documentation and evidence collection and the front of our troopers to complete and a referral investigation. Criminal justice tech to provide additional support for our missing purposes for in-house criminal. We have one person who we're currently modernizing our database to track missing people who stand in Alaska. We've also moved missing persons starting housing team on the last report investigations to put an investigative component into it. Prior to that, it was housing our search and rescue component. We finally better served the movement to our investigative unit to provide terrible investigations and missing people, missing persons in our state. As we've talked about in our previous conversations, the departments asked for two tribal liaisons to provide more direct contact and interface and partnerships with our tribes that we provide services to. I see that as a key to the success of our program in rural Alaska. And then the increase of 10 village public safety officers and helping with the ball signing to rural Alaska. We're currently in the process of hiring an AST investigator to focus just on UNIPD investigations. That person is a retired last state trooper, Trooper Ann Sears. She's scheduled to start on April 1st. We see that as an issue set forward from the department. She's been most of her career in Western Alaska. She retired out of the Catskill region. She is an Alaska native. She's at next season late. Last minute female that we've ever had retired from the department after 25 years. So we're really excited in the direction we're going there. And basically, what in my conversations with her, what I told her, she's back from college and how she wants to run investigations when it comes to missing and murdered indigenous people, and including reviewing some of our case investigations in that topic. So I don't Mark are coming on board April 1st. We do think that working through the West Attorney's Office, we're actually going to write for that position, even though we want to put that position in regardless of the federal funding. It's always good to have the federal government as a partner when we're dealing with serious topics in rural Alaska. We recently, recently signed. Seven aspirant investigators from Alaska that includes one of them, three on Bethel, and also one. But regardless, their focus was conducting criminal investigations, high-quality criminal investigations in rural Alaska, but we found that that's what free up our troopers, to spend more time in our communities out there and handling some of the lower level crimes that are certainly growing in that region of the state. I want to also point to as Alabama students start missing persons under 21, well, that we've authored and support that will make it mandatory for law enforcement agencies to report to the department that they've been a missing person between the age of 18 and 21 prior that arrives to help with missing children. And the reason for that is it gets those college kids, kids that are college kids or really not kids at that point having college student age that end up disappearing from our campuses, and it allows for quicker notification that they're missing. And as you know, families and residents, Alaska doesn't have a 24-hour requirement to report a missing person, and it's always better to report as soon as you know they're missing, regardless if it turns out they're not, because times and hours when we're talking about missing people or persons, especially in the state of Alaska. We're working closely again, like I said, with the U.S. Attorney's Office to provide more resources to the department to tackle this important issue. Well, we'll take any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have a time to bring members for questions and to take advantage of being the chosen to the commissioner, we'll be sort of working on not missing and murdering Indigenous persons overall, but really focusing on the male heritage Indigenous women within this committee in 2019. We heard testimony that a lot of the contributing difficulties around the crisis with missing and murdering Indigenous women and people really lies within incomplete data collection by law enforcement when interpersonal violence is being reported and cases are being undertaken, as well as some cross-jurisdictional issues, maybe information that doesn't get communicated between municipal officers, state officers, and so between incomplete data collection of an individual's ethnicity or cultural background, aligned with some difficulty in terms of sharing that communication between whether it's municipal law enforcement, tribes, state law enforcement, federal resources, that has all contributed to the crisis that we see in the U.S. I'm curious to hear a little bit more specifically how the department plans to address those issues through these expanded positions. And if you could clarify, is it the department's expectation to prioritize this work largely through the additional budget request for these additional positions in this fiscal year?
So, the chair, those are really good questions. Yeah, I think one of the biggest places it's to our advantage now is, this is out there. I mean, the governor's called it a different order on the 329th and all of that. We've certainly called the local police department, state police department, Farmers Police Department, or some of our smaller departments now. As the CI, there's a priority, as this department. And with, again, I see that as part of our case with our tribal liaisons when they do have a even by missing an accommodation at the beginning, because usually they're putting this missing person. That allows better communications with the tribes that are actually out there dealing with the initial response to those people that are called the search. Because that's usually what they come into, is the search kind of expands into something a little bit greater than that, including it on the homicide. So with that said, one of the things we did then was TCC came and asked us to give them our search and rescue authority with their members, which we did. I brought them a program that authorizes them a lot more leeway when they're providing search efforts for the members up out of the Providence region and TCC's region. And hopefully, because they've seen some interference with us staying with law enforcement, with their search for their tribal members. So, we have a partnership with these states to give them some more authority to provide their resources to continue the searches when potentially law enforcement wasn't continuing with the search to the efforts that they set up. So, it's a commitment the department has to make is to ensure that we're collecting the information needed to better and find out on the outbound, but to the other police department as well, because the public wants to know, and also try to get closer to the families of the missing and potentially murdered individuals.
How much of this ongoing work could be incorporated into your broader continuing education? I think, I'm surprised to learn that that's not a requirement for law enforcement professionals, as it is for professionals in many other sectors. And I think, some of these things, when we talk about mental health, we talk about trauma, when we talk about issues of missing and murdered Indigenous people, these are sort of things that have evolved over time and, sort of taken, there's a new set of information. But I just wonder professional so that they can be receiving more timely information in a more systemic way that, you know, it's going to happen with them on the journey.
And we help this drug that we have proposed and if you use that dose of with a lot of these issues. So that's what's my concern around it is, you know, that's really what I'm around is more information for information sharing from our part and from the organizations that we have specifically. Sounds like a problematic or not learned and we haven't done it, haven't looked into it, you know, make sure like that the number they have for them that they can go back and take a look at it and say if we get the closure to that thing.
Next, we're going to turn to Valerie Chadwick from RealPath. Ms. Chadwick, thank you for joining us today. If you could begin by introducing yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, good morning. My name is Valerie Chadwick. I'm a community development manager at RealPath. My primary duties are to develop, sustain our domestic violence shelter in Hooper Bay in partnership with the Native Village of Hooper Bay, the Native Village of Quebec, and the Native Village of Hamburg Bay. In addition to the domestic violence shelter work that we provide, we also are working on the renovation and implementation of the Child Advocacy Center to address child sexual abuse in those three tribes also. I come to you with 30 years of social service experience. My work has always been in social services, working with tribes across the inclusive access area. I've also worked for Anchorage in Sitka. And I believe that my appointment with the governor's office, I have my first meeting tomorrow to learn about my new duties. But the reason I had applied for that role and to be a part of that council was because I think that throughout the work that I've been doing with victims of crime, victims of substance abuse, in the whole field of social service, that when we end up with people who have been victimized, or have been murdered, it's been very unfortunate. I think about high school students. And he was somebody that we don't have to take a look at because our folks that are joining us on Teams or my drop a phone number into the chat, and we're hoping that you can dial in by phone because we're having some communication issues on our end, so we're losing some of the testimony. So we're going to take a brief leave, but we're going to send you a phone number so that you can dial in by phone and ask you to join this special community on tribal affairs. So briefings. Apple record. We are going to be dropping the video chat box for our testifying as an individual. If our subsequent testifiers can connect to call in for backup audio, that would be better. In the meantime, Ms. Chadwick, if you could try to unmute your audio but leave your video disconnected, our technological folks are recommending to give that a try and see if that helps. So apologies for having a delay, but we wanted to make sure that your testimony is open. So if you can go ahead and unmute your line for your audio, and I think you were telling us about why you had applied for the Governor's Council on Disability Relations Persons.
Thank you, Representative. So this is Valerie. I applied for the council because of all the work I've been doing in the past 30 years, stemming from the missing report of Sally Yvonne when I lived in Bethel to the state still on the murdered and missing Indigenous Peoples List. I really appreciate the testimony of James Cockrell for his willingness to participate and collaborate with this council. I will know exactly what my duties are until tomorrow, so I really can share with you the passion that I have and the work that we do to address the collective trauma. I understand our trauma response as individuals, I understand it as a collective, and we're at a point now where that's where we can begin moving forward to find answers to the to prepare our report for the governor that provides the recommendations for the development of public awareness, education, and outreach campaigns for affected communities, to provide recommendations for improving interagency cooperation, knowledge of the missing persons protocols, and recommendations for improving public safety in tribal communities that have no law enforcement presence, and also the recommendations on ways to improve investigations, including data information collection and sharing. Throughout the work that we've been doing and the partnerships that we've developed, I feel that I'm very hopeful that as MMIP issues arise, that we continue to explore solutions and figuring out how can we improve the system, the delivery service delivery system, so that way, you know, we have a reduction in these crimes. I feel very passionate. I feel very hopeful. And I believe that prevention is a huge aspect with people who are not recovering but continually faced with this trauma. It's been almost a weekly part of my life where I see people wondering, where is so-and-so? Have you heard of so-and-so? Only to find out the next day that they've been murdered. To see people who worked in the field of social service with the hopes that we can provide a stronger system of care because they've lost a loved one in the 80s and still haven't found them. And these are in the communities that I serve. In the communities that I'm from, because I'm an allergic tribal member, and this is something I face every day as a woman. And I thank God every day that I'm awake, that I'm alive, that I'm not missing. And this is the hope and the work that I'm going to be doing, because now I have 4 daughters. And statistically, half of our children, half of our women, have experienced dying or some type of domestic violence. And that number is way too high. And we need to come up with a way, and I look forward to working with the partners, with all of you, in ways that we can implement, and see what works. I to address the crisis that's been happening basically every day. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony at this time. We are honored to be with you in your social service work in the life of the time. We would appreciate your leadership in that area as well as your commitment to serving the Los Angeles City Council. Very pleasant to be with you on this trip.
Thank you so much for the presentation and you for the opportunity to learn more about the project in the UK. And through colleagues of yours that joined us for one of our Poverty and Opportunity Task Force first meetings, I didn't remember that Bill had mentioned that the CAC was also going on. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what's happening there. And as I understand it, the shelter that went in was really collaboration of multiple partners, and is that the same kind of model that's being used for the CAC?
Thank you for asking. As a matter of fact, it is. We've collaborated with Food Tribes, Miami Bay, Hooper Bay, and TBAC. We have a action group together where we sat and we talked about what impact has the shelter had in the past year and a half on victims of crime, and we've successfully assisted well over 100 women and children, and we continue to do that despite COVID. We practice our COVID mitigation plan, so we figured we would see more people, but because of social distancing, we can only have 7 to 10 people in a shelter. But with the Child Advocacy Center, we did meet together, all of the advocacy groups. We talked about what was working and talked about what still needs to be done. So we were able to partner and apply for federal funding for the Child Advocacy Center. So right now, we've just been awarded travel citizen funds. So now we're recruiting for a new Child Advocacy Center coordinator who assists with me and my other partners in developing and renovating the space that was provided to us by one of the Native corporations. And we have outreach workers and CHIVAC, who serves CHIVAC and Salmon Bay as an advocate there because we needed a way to help victims of crime or women to come in and have somebody to talk to right there. And that is the same philosophy with the Child Advocacy Center. We are going to partner with the regional multidisciplinary team in Bethel, with the Gender Women's Coalition, with Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, with Victims of Justice, with all of our partners statewide. And so we're very excited about that endeavor. Because it's we need to be able to provide those local health services. We don't want to increase trauma to people going to children going through child sexual abuse exams. Thank you.
Thank you, Mom. Sorry, I would just say you're doing so much amazing work, and the collaborations are so inspiring.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. It was great. I really do appreciate it. And my question is, either through your district and it goes out to regions or through, if you have access to this great data, et cetera, the issue of violence against women and children obviously is on the forefront. My question is it, from your perspective, something that's always been there, something that's more of an increasing problem, a decreasing problem, and what would be the issue and what would be the reason from your perspective as to why, in fact, it's an increasing problem or
Thank you for your question. From my experience working with a lot of people in the past 30 years, some of the people I've worked with are good. Did you substance abuse issues and tried ordered and missing people? Some people are recovery. Some people are not grandparents. Some people are not great grandparents. And I've worked in the child welfare system, as Representative Salkowski mentioned. And I worked in primarily the 56 IDC people issues. And I've seen changes that have been positive. I've seen an increase in the preventative services. I've seen tribes stepping up and intervening in family issues instead of calling the state child welfare system. It's become a lot more ownership. And I think throughout the years, I think the system is improving because people are becoming self-determined. And they're understanding issues that never were talked about. Don't tap, don't trust, don't fear. The basic secret keeping of holding in that dysfunction. But to start seeing people have the support from our government, from our local leaders, having open discussion, open forum, has given people that faith and that trust that I can talk about this, I can help somebody. And I see that happening. I see that happening in the village of Hoover Bay, Chibok, and Salmon Bay. I see it in Bethel with the multidisciplinary team. That multidisciplinary team has gotten a lot stronger since, I can say I think it was 1994, when I belonged to the sexual abuse response team initiative in Bethel. Before there was a child advocacy center at the Journal Coalition. So I see organizations coming together, collaborating, talking, and taking ownership. And I think that's very powerful. And I think the numbers have increased because people are disclosing. People are feeling safe to share. People are feeling empowered to tell their story. I don't know if the problem has decreased, but I know that our response has increased. I know our faith in the work that we do is strengthening. And as I look at other people on this call, I think, yes, I can know a few of these names because they're also part of the collective team that we're doing to empower and promote healing. Thank you. I hope that answered your question.
Very much, and thank you for that. It was, with a lot of sense, enlightening, and also was hoped on. So, thanks, so thank you.
All right, thank you. Committee members, thank you, Ms. Chadwick, for working with us today. And if you don't mind staying on the line, if we have additional questions, we will come back to you. It does appear that not having video on has helped the connections for folks who dialed in. Quick note, if you'd also dialed in on the phone, please feel free to hang up or come in box so we don't get any people on your end. Next, we're going to hear from Deborah O'Gara from the Western Women's Resource Center. Ms. O'Gara, I know we've had dialogues about this issue when we started working on it in 2019 and 2020. Thank you for your leadership on it. If you could begin by introducing yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Okay, thank you so much, and thank you for the invitation. My name is Deborah O'Gara, and I am the senior policy specialist for the Western Union Women's Resource Center. I am also Cricket and Beckett Irish, and my Cricket name is Jeanette Sook, and I am part of it from Petersburg, which is just across the channel from my ancestral lands in Rainbow, and I also spent much of my childhood in Mountain Village, which is my mother's home village. So I want to thank you. I'll just jump in and then I have a short presentation. And I'm so happy to follow with Ms. Chadwick and the commissioner, and was really inspired by things that both of them had decided. So I'm happy to follow up with them. I sent through Logan two fact sheets that I hope was able to get distributed to the committee members. And in there is some of the, not all of them, but some of the statistics and data around missing and murdered indigenous women. I also sent you a fact sheet about the missing violence. We, as Ms. Chadwick mentioned, the connection between missing and murdered indigenous people across the state, which I think everybody has, including the governor, yes, red is a huge problem that needs to have some coordinated attention to it. The connection to our missing and murdered indigenous people is really connected to domestic violence, sexual assault, and other violence, as I think Representative Ortiz's question, just previous question, really alluded to. And many of us in the communities have been working for decades to bring attention to this issue. And I have to say, I am thoroughly delighted to see the commissioner, the head of the state public safety, talk about the provisions that are being made, both institutionalizing those changes, not just adding those changes on to as a stopgap measure, but it appeared to me to be actually institutionalizing further investigation, further communication, further training. Those are all things that we in the community addressing this issue have been asking for. And all we can do is apply those efforts and say, let's keep going, because it's interesting me, and it's going to divert a little bit from what I was going to say, because I think Representative Ortiz's question about has the violence always been there, is it increasing or decreasing? And I'll just add to what Ms. Chadwick had said, which is the violence has not always been there. The Alaska Native people lived in this territory for tens of thousands of years with no violence against each other, not only is it worth the violence, it certainly has increased and become a problem since the settlers came in and started settling this territory. And that could be a whole other talk, so I'll go right over that and say the violence has not always been here, but it has been here since certainly the Russians and its engagement. Are the numbers increasing? I think the numbers are increasing, primarily because there has been an underreporting of domestic violence, sexual assault, and missing persons. There's also been a category of the homicides in the state, either through intentional or unintentional, actually doesn't matter, but we have found that many of the deaths that do go to a medical panel or never go to the medical center are being categorized as accidental or suicide, when in fact they are often homicide. And so let me just add that to the list of things that I think that the state would benefit from paying attention to, and that would be establishing something that the Western Works has found that they said, and that is a fatality review team that could go in and work with the state agencies to better fill in the boxes and ask the questions. There's a similar fatality review team that's been in place concerning infant deaths, and we're just asking that be expanded. Are the numbers increasing? I think the numbers are always very high. I think Ms. Chadwick is absolutely correct. The responses and the reports have been increasing. They've been increasing because law enforcement in the state have been responding, at least in the last couple of years, in a more positive way. There's been a lack of reporting of violence of any kind, whether it's domestic, interfamily, or sexual in nature, because there's been a history of not responding or blaming the victim. And some of that is due to no law enforcement in our communities, or some of it is just a slow response. And obviously something that Commissioner Crockwell was mentioning about the 24-hour, waiting 24 hours before reporting somebody missing. And I'm happy that from the top down, the message is starting to get out that folks do not have to wait 24 hours. Unfortunately, on the ground, some of the information is still being portrayed as, well, coming back to our line and we'll start investigating. So I think the main message I have, and then I'll stop to take any questions. We're happy to see that more services or more resources are going into investigation and communication with law enforcement. And we have several tools that we can draw the community's attention to. One is a toolkit that was put out by the Office of Human Resource Center just last year. We are circulating it throughout our communities that we work with, and it talks about steps to go through when somebody in your community has gone missing. On the second page of the fact sheet that I sent you, it has just a highlight of some of the steps, but it's a multi-page guideline for communities to develop their own response system. And the key there is to communicate with law enforcement, which the commissioner was talking about also. There's certainly other things, but that's the one that's key. And there's also the NYP work group that's headed by Ingrid Kovalich, who is also working with communities to develop response for communities. And I would just kind of talk with Ingrid about this. It's also, we're also glad that law enforcement itself, because there's so many different layers, and certainly this could be coordinated through the Department of Public Safety, as being at the top tier of most of the law enforcement agencies, is having a law enforcement response plan as well. And because what happens is, some of you might know, you go into any one of our rural communities, and there could be as many as four or five different jurisdictions involved. And sometimes you cross the street or cross the river and you're in a different jurisdiction. And when you're doing search or investigation of a murder, those jurisdictional lines aren't being followed by the victim or the perpetrator. But unfortunately, they do end up getting followed or signed by law enforcement. And so I think a response plan by law enforcement on how to navigate those jurisdictional, just call them barriers, would be very effective. The other thing that hasn't been mentioned yet, and I'm not sure what role this committee might be able to play in that, is prosecution. Often our victims don't report because there's a lack of prosecution. And I know that one thing that we've tried to look at just reasons for not filing charges against somebody, and certainly going into the Department of Law or into the prosecutorial decision making can be a little touchy. And what we would just talk about that as one area to take a look at. If there was an increase in prosecutions by perpetrators of violence against Alaska Natives, I think that, again, just like we're seeing with the response in law enforcement, positive response in law enforcement, there would be another increase or maybe spike in reports because then something could be done. I just want to end that part of the presentation by saying I'm not convinced that prosecution is the full answer to the balance. Certainly prevention, and this is where Ms. Chadwick and I really agree. Prevention is the key. It's always better to prevent the violence to begin with, or when violence happens, to respond to it as quickly as possible so that the perpetrator can stop being violent and behaving in that way, and the victims, especially the children and women, can be safe in a safe world. The last thing I want to share, and the commissioner brought this up, there are several groups besides the Women's Resource Center where I work that are working on this. And we do work together. And I know that communication and working together is certainly something. I know I am the representative for not a coalition or a formally formed committee, but we certainly are a work group. We meet on a weekly basis and collaborate and coordinate our efforts and also share information. Those organizations are the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, Native People's Action, Alaska Native Heritage Center, the Native Movement, the Alaska Native Indigenous Justice, and the Alaska Native Justice Center. So, of course, we also turn out for occasional events. We'll work with other groups as well. And I would encourage this committee to reach out to any one of those organizations. There is an excellent collection of data that has been formed. It was released last year. It was put out by the Data for Indigenous Justice. It's called We Are Calling to You. And it's those numbers, the official federal numbers, indicated that missing and murdered Indigenous people were very high, and the We Are Calling to You report that came out last year actually increased it, and that currently just in Alaska there are 149 missing, and 80 of those who have been murdered, and an additional 80 who have been murdered, and that was now numbers that are, I think, 18, 12 to 18 months old, and those numbers are continuing to increase because I believe we don't have enough resources and efforts being put into the prevention part of this issue. And I'll stop there and take any questions.
And we have a question from some of your representative fields.
Very comprehensive and thoughtful testimony. I appreciate your mention of the importance of adequate prosecutorial capacity. That's something that we've really wrestled with over the years. And I think that our best practice makes within the regard of bad prosecutorial capacity in Western Alaska. The governor vetoed that a couple years ago, along with funding for VPS and ISOB and for health. But, you know, as I see it, I think we're going to turn a corner here. Very exciting to hear about added investigative capacity in the Department of Public Safety. I appreciate the commissioner doing that. I remember back in 2019 talking with the previous commission about the need to look at these locations and get additional investigative capacity. So I feel like with more support now for prosecution, more investigative capacity, we have the opportunity to turn the corner. I did a question. We have been struggling for some time to provide adequate behavioral health treatment capacity, given the nexus between alcoholism and other substance misuse and crime. So, Ms. O'Hara, would you say that the ability to treat substance misuse to reduce the incidence of alcoholism and other substance misuse also reduces the incidence of the violence and inappropriate violence?
Through the chair, Representative refuses to answer the question, and I'm not sure I'm the best qualified person to answer that, but I will take a stab. I've been a practice attorney for 31 years, and in the last 16 years, I have been a judicial officer. And it's interesting that I've been known amongst my colleagues to adamantly say I'm not a social worker, right? A clinician, but I certainly have spent much of my career around the issues surrounding mental health, behavioral health, treatment programs, and the like. Before I go to your question, I appreciate the efforts being made to increase the prosecution and speak as a former prosecutor in for trials now in Washington State. On the issue of substance abuse and mental health, you know, it's interesting. My take on it is that the substance abuse and much of the mental health, especially being experienced by Alaska Natives, not just in Alaska but around the country, is really a product of internalized racism and historical trauma. And while I am a full proponent of increasing mental health and behavioral health treatment, especially for drug and alcohol substance abuse, you can't just treat that as a symptom. So my take is that you can't just address the substance abuse. You have to go deeper and address the reasons for the individual using the substance, which is just shortening it, self-medication, or a response to just complete despair from the historical trauma. Some of that historical trauma is heightened as our new generations emerge because of the violence. So it's one of those things where we grow up in violent homes and then become violent or accepting the violence as a normal behavior, which it is not. And unfortunately, so many of our families grow up within that violence and then it becomes commonplace or not as abnormal. Now, of course, that's changing, and as Ms. Chadwick indicated, the more we talk about it, the more we unbound that veil of silence, or hiding the issues behind closed doors, the more folks are within our families are learning that this isn't normal, and there is other ways to deal with issues. So, I think I might be on your question, but the more we talk about it, the more people who are experiencing issues will feel more comfortable, isn't the right word, more able to talk about it because they'll know that there's help there. But in order to get them to talk about and for us to prevent some of these issues, there has to be some treatment out there. It has to be comprehensive and in-depth.
Thanks, Manager, for giving me a testify for your thoughts on any information that recalls us. I appreciate that. For the bullet point, that discussion that recalls us.
Another question on that time.
We hope that this is the beginning of a discussion that we will continue to have in this committee. Thank you, Ms. O'Gara. Thank you, Ms. Chadwick, and to the Commissioner for our continued discussion of this issue. We will certainly be returning to it and appreciate your time this morning. Next, we will be turning to hearing of House Bill 303, Banning Self-Representative Result Rescue relating to the College Public Safety Officer Program. We will take a brief video strike and temporarily hand off the gavel to Representative Fields so that we staff might be visited at the presenter's table. Please.
years. Happy COVID every year. Representative for the basket was staff for here with 2% on bill before COVID.
Thank you, Representative Fields, and Representative Bell, Special Committee on Federal Affairs. For the record, there are many students on this evening, and Representative Lasca helps District 38 as well as the office of her health care in the state house.
Do you have further payload to make this schedule to district? Thank you, Chair Fields. For the record,
healthcare sector presented for testing. HB 4138 for recommendations in the Guidelines and Council of Urban Works report, which was adopted on January 24th, 2020. And we can understand how it's bad because they were caught in their budget, so we went through all of the recommendations. The largest difference, or the only difference between this bill and the previous bill, recommended by Representative Haupt, is that HB 4138 keeps the DCSM brand management within the Department of Public Safety. Which brand is possible within the executive analysis. Section 1 is the statute regarding the criminal history background checks and the DCSM personnel as incorporated in the Department of Public Safety. DPS, and the authorized to secure background checks via the FBI. Section 2, related to Section 1, and that's the statute requiring DPS to secure the background check for the DSL program personnel. Sections 1 and 2 implement Recommendation 2 regarding the need to create more financial flexibility for the program, and they also make it clear that background checks are a DPS function for the DSL program. Section 3 proposes to repeal and reenact the statute and add multiple new subsections, most for the purposes of cleanup. Subsection A has been rewritten to conform to the current legislative draft manual and updates DPSO police empowers. Subsection B removes the unnecessary life sentence of Section B. Subsection C is nailed up and codified standards and implements Recommendation 9. Subsection D is now abandoned. The statutory codification of current DPS regulations prevents the payment of bonuses and other non-DPSO grant revenue sources. All authorities are required to grantees and identify the state. These changes implement Recommendations 2, 4, and 9. Subsection E is now abandoned as the partial statutory codification of current DPS regulations. The subsection sets the overall policy that one VPSO is generally assigned to one bullet to which the granting organization requests additional VPSO personnel per village. The changes result in more neutral and less harsh tone of language in the regulation. Subsection S was now to allow for traveling or roving VPSO personnel who were permitted to travel between villages within a grantee's region if public safety needs arise. These changes implement Recommendations 1, 2, and 9. Subsection 9 is new and is the partial statutory codification of current DPS regulations. The subsection contains grant award record keeping requirements and other agreements and requirements. These changes implement Recommendations 1, 2, and 9. Subsection H requires or contains new regulation adopting authorities for the DPS commissioner subject to the new consultation requirements in subsection L of this new section. These changes implement Recommendations 1, 2, and 8. Subsection I allows for funding granting organizations indirect grants up to a CYA rate of 35%. This language has been used as a general language in multiple prior operating budget bills. These changes also implement Recommendations 2, 4, and 5. Indirect costs are related to the CMX service provided by DPS in support of licensing troopers and then home office costs associated with the program. Subsection K provides explicit instructions to the commissioner on grant fund disbursement. Specifically, the grant funds can be used for items reasonably related to public safety and DPSO duties as codified in this bill. Further, grant fund disbursement is to be timely and can request the amount to be unreasonably withheld. These changes partially implement Recommendation 2. Subsections K and L are related to subsection I and provides for a consultation and negotiated rulemaking process for when any of the state agencies involved with the DPSO program exercise their regulation adopted authority. These changes implement Recommendation 8. Section 4 creates new statutes and includes a statutory qualification of current DPS regulation dealing with the DPSO qualification requirements. These changes implement Recommendation 9 and includes a statutory qualification of current DPS regulation dealing with DPSO background checks, implementing Recommendation 9 and includes statutory qualification of current DPS regulation dealing with DPSO training requirements. regulations dealing with the use of firearm training requirements, personal recommendation alone. They include statutory clarification of the abuse regulation of the abuse of certification, which includes recommendation 9. They include statutory clarification of current DPS regulation dealing with the denial or revocation or lapse of the DPS certificate, which includes recommendation 9. That includes the duties and functions of the DPSO personnel are currently performing by the MAC, codifying the existing statute, which includes recommendation 1. And it includes a definition section to deal with various terms used in the statutory sections. Section 5 on page 13 creates a new codified law, a standard brief on the provisions for existing DPSO personnel who may have been certified under different training requirements than what is provided for in this bill. Section 6 on page 14 creates an uncodified law, a requirement that DPS continue its current level of interaction between itself and the DPSO personnel. The requirement is codified between DPSO, with the language relating to DPS regulation authority extending to, quote, the interaction between the Department of Public Safety and Public Safety Officers, unquote. This regulation is maintained by Bill Section 3I, which uses the exact wording regarding DPS regulation authority. Section 7 is a effective date provision that provides that the subsections entered the overpayment will be enacted as a consecutive law facility to become effective on July 1st, 2022. These subsections are proposed codifications and modifications of current Department of Regulations, as well as the Department of Time to take action and make the Department of Regulations consistent with the new provisions of statute and the bill. And then Section 8 provides that all other sections of the bill have been made effective. Nice and brief. Thank you. Other questions on this question?
Mr. Chair, I could just add that although it sounds like we're making it more functional, the language currently reflected in this version of House Bill 3.3 was previously amended through the committee as well as the Judiciary Committee. Further, it has already been vetted, or this language has already been vetted through the Legal Committee and the Legal Affairs, as well as the State Affairs and the other body. And so there's now a lot of bipartisan, bicameral fingers of this language, really, again, with the shared intent about improving rural public safety. And again, I think I've gotten to this point without the voice of the family permanent, as well as all of the media and contractors who are helping to do some work on the ground.
Yes, I was just wanted to comment that the efforts from the bipartisan community there yet. From a budget area, I feel like it's gotten almost zero public attention, but really it's a massive undertaking. That's what I personally asked from Western Horizon to the interior, to Anchorage, to the Valley, to the stakeholders you just mentioned, and it's frankly an inspiring effort that I've been able to pass the bill this year because clearly Ben Belvedere is well informed and does address the misnomer of the trust person's issue, which is really. So if anyone else has any questions, then I'm going to go back to the person who is the expert on this. I'll go back to my center. And again, you sort of
testimony from Director Joel Hart of the Department of Public Safety. Director Hart, if you could begin by introducing yourself to the record and begin your testimony. Let me see you online, Director Hart, that you are on mute. Yes, we hear you. Thank you so much, Director Hart. Please continue.
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Jim McGraw. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety, Business Public Safety Officer Program here in Anchorage. I'm also your primary committee person, and I'm pleased to offer my support for the response
committee members. All right, so thank you, Director Barr, for joining us today. Please feel free to stay online in the event that you have time and there might be additional questions. Now we will turn to Amber Bathko from the Care Activities Conference. Ms. Bathko, if you could begin by introducing yourself and your record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Sulkowski and the members of the House Travel and Affairs Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Amber Bathko. I'm UVic and an ANIAC travel member living here in Fairbanks. I currently serve as the Executive Director of Travel Government and Client Services with the Clean Energy Conference. PCC's region covers an area of 235,000 square miles in interior Alaska, serving the interior 42 communities, including 37 federally recognized tribes. In addition to calling on behalf of PCC, I'm also offering testimony on behalf of the Alaska Regional Coalition, a consortium of four Alaska Native regional nonprofits and one regional tribe. Our group includes the Central Council of Tlingit Haida, Manulit, Tsuvachnu, Kuwarik, and TCC. Collectively, we represent 100 communities and approximately 65,000 people. TCC's number one priority is BPSL reform. Public safety is essential to our communities. Throughout the years, TCC's membership has passed resolutions requesting improvements to public safety in our communities. Even our youth have recognized the importance of public safety, submitting Resolution 2020-14, Youth Request to Improve Village Public Safety. To meet our client's request, TCC focused extensive resources to find ways to improve public safety in our communities, including the operation of the BPSL program. Prior to the legislative working group's formation and starting in 2016, TCC recognized the need for a BPSL contractor caucus, where all the BPSL grantees work together to agree on proposed solutions to develop BPSL grant contract and the standard operating procedures. And through these meetings, it quickly became clear that the program must be reformed to provide flexibility so it can be reflective of the needs at a local level in rural Alaska to ensure the safety of our community members. Each year, through the budgeting process, we watched as our lawmakers acknowledged that there were battles within the program, and our contractors met with each of you to express frustration over the grant management and regulatory restrictions that made it difficult to carry out the mission. In 2017, when coordinators suggested thinking outside the box for recruitment and retention strategies, the answer from BPS then was that the Alaska State Troopers is not doing this, so the BPSOs cannot. In 2018, BPSO contractors were hopeful when the appropriations for the BPS included legislative intent language that supported recruitment and retention of BPSOs, including the consideration of salary increases. The discussion in subcommittee that year was for us contemplating the better utilization of field positions or housing multiple BPSOs in a single community if beneficial to public safety. But this never came to fruition throughout the contract, and the contractors constantly remained a part of this intent. The need for true systematic change was emphasized even more so in 2019. In February of that year, when the state budget was revealed, DPS identified BPSO funds that they believed would not be spent in all rural travel, academy travel, fuel for patrol cars, maintenance, and field training. The program was basically inoperable. And how did DPS decide they could take these actions? They relied on the Alaska statutes that gives the commissioner authority to remove lax funding. And a reminder here that none of the other agencies was in DPS lax funding. Additionally, in 2019, sections of the grant solicitation were removed, such as roaming activities of the BPSO coordinators, and this confused the contractors on plane. In that plane, the PPSO program's mission is that every community that needs and wants PPSO coverage can have that service without hindrance or worry, and this goal is vital to reach that vision. So I agree there's never truly a non-controversial piece of legislation these days, but if there was a bill to support that will make a direct and lasting impact on the lives of thousands of Alaskans, this is it. So please support HB 313. And that concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gaspia, for your testimony, as well as your excellent evaluation of the complicated nature of the work that we're undertaking. Any questions for Ms. Gaspia? Next, we will hear from Karen Escoil from Comeric. Ms. Escoil, if you can begin by introducing yourself and your affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Karen Escoil. I'm at one of the small community tribes in Maine, and I'm the Vice President of Community Services for the Division of Comeric. Tribal Affairs Committee meeting. The time is 9:36 a.m. and this hearing is on the Tribal Affairs Committee of 9:32.